Peter Woodcock was born in 1939 in Peterborough, Ontario. His mother was only a 17-year-old factory worker. She was unable to care for the boy, so she was forced to leave him to a foster family. Now, during the first 3 years of his life, Peter was difficult. He had little success in the foster care system. He would cry constantly. He would scream. He was uncontrollable. One of the families he was fostered to physically abused him. They inflicted serious injuries on his neck. Finally, when Peter was 3 years old, a family from Toronto adopted Peter, and they were able to form a bond with the child. They were the Maynards, but they would grow more and more worried about their adopted son's psyche as the years went on. Although Peter had mellowed as the years passed, he never would really become what you would consider a normal child. There were many improvements within Peter, but he was still considered awkward. He was a loner. He spent a lot of time being bullied, fighting, or simply running from bullies. And according to his mother, Peter had a great fear of other children. During one discussion with a social worker, Peter admitted that he wished that something would blow up and kill all the other children. Now, Peter's mother paid top dollar for this therapy, but nothing seemed to work. Peter showed many early signs of being a psychopath, including harming and killing small animals. He would eventually claim that he had engaged in sexual activity with children as young as 12 years old. These claims foreshadowed the crimes Peter would commit years later. At the age of 17, Peter's best and only friends weren't real. He treasured his bicycle. Peter had dreamed of a gang of his own, the Winchester Heights Gang. And he would ride his bike through Toronto every day. September 15th, 1956. Peter was out riding his bike when he encountered Wayne Mallett playing on his grandmother's lawn. 17-year-old Peter Woodcock lured the child from the lawn and killed the boy. Wayne was only 7 years old. When Wayne's body was found a few days later on the deserted Toronto exhibition grounds, police recognized the missing child. Peter had taken the boy to the secluded exhibition grounds. He assaulted him. Upon examining the body, it also revealed that Peter had bitten Wayne in two places, and unexplainably, pennies were scattered across the scene of the crime. Perhaps this was meant to be his calling card. It also appeared as if someone, possibly Peter himself, defecated near the body of the boy. It was obvious at this point that Peter had no respect for the child, and he felt no remorse for what he had done. Without science to aid this investigation, police arrested another man, Ronald Mowat, and Peter went free. Because of this error, Peter remained a threat to the children of Toronto. And he went on to strike again less than 3 months later. Gary Morris was 9 years old, and his body was found on Cherry Beach. It was never truly clear whether Gary had gone with Peter willingly. Tragically for Gary Morris, there weren't very many visitors that night he was murdered. Gary's cause of death was a ruptured liver caused by the beating he had suffered while Peter attempted to strangle him. Again, Peter had removed his victim's clothes. He left bite marks all over the skin. Instead of pennies at this scene, Peter had brought along several paper clips to scatter about the crime scene. But the police failed to make any connection. Peter Woodcock's MO was consistent, and he would repeat it once more, only months later. His final child victim was Carol Voice. She took a ride on the back of Peter's bicycle at only 4 years old. The two of them were seen heading towards the Bloor Viaduct. Carol was choked to death and found in a state of undress. Peter came home the night of the killing, a sweet, normal child, his hands and face clean, his clothes spotless. The young killer's newfound boldness would soon catch up to him. Police were able to put together a composite sketch, and witnesses remembered seeing Peter fleeing the area on his bicycle. This was completely out of the ordinary, to be riding your bike during the winter months. The bicycle had carried Peter all over Toronto. That had been his only companion. So the police were able to track him down just 2 days after the crime. On January 21st, 1957. Peter's arrest would not put an end to his crimes. He confessed to all three murders while in custody, but he showed little remorse for his actions. He showed little regard for the life of his victims. If the police had not caught him, it seems likely that Peter would have struck again. Police went on to charge Peter Woodcock and let the man who was wrongfully arrested for Wayne Mallett's death go free. Peter's only concern, though, through this entire ordeal, was whether his mother would find out what he had done. Peter was tried for Carol's murder, and during his trial, lawyers called multiple psychiatrists to testify regarding Peter's sanity. The defense was successful, and Peter was found not guilty by reason of insanity. This meant that instead of going to jail, Peter Woodcock would be institutionalized. Now, during his time in Ontario's Oak Ridge Maximum Security Hospital, Peter was made to partake in experimental therapy programs. Part of this program was the administration of LSD. In 1967, a total encounter capsule was added to the program. It was an 8x10 windowless empty room with only a one-way mirror and lights that never shut off. The capsule was one of the reasons that a judge ruled in 2017 that Oak Ridge staff had tortured their patients. Peter Woodcock was drugged and held in the capsule for days at a time until the programs were ended in the 1970s. But the early 1980s brought winds of change for Peter. He was being evaluated for potential release and had been transferred to a maximum security facility. In 1982, he legally changed his name from Peter Woodcock to David Michael Kruger. July 13th, 1991, Peter, who is now David, was given his first taste of freedom. He had been institutionalized for 34 years. Security guard Bruce Hamill accompanied Peter on his voyage into the free world. Hamill had been an inmate alongside Peter at Oak Ridge, and the two had been involved, romantically. Their plan for the day was to get ice cream at a nearby Dairy Queen. Instead, Peter had arranged to meet with former fellow inmate Dennis Kerr under the pretense of discussing a loan. When Kerr arrived at the meeting spot, Peter was waiting for him with an assortment of weapons. Those weapons were provided for him by Hamill, who had been persuaded to assist his partner. Peter beat Kerr with a wrench before stabbing him to death. He sexually assaulted Kerr, mutilated him, and sodomized the corpse. Hamill stood by before taking OTC sleeping pills and dozing off at the scene of the crime. After the deed was done, Peter walked to the nearest police station and turned himself in. He spent less than an hour in the free world that day. Peter was sent back to Oak Ridge and died of natural causes on his birthday, March 5th, 2010. He was 71 years old. It was 54 years since he had first killed. Throughout his life, people had tried to fix Peter. His parents, therapists, Oak Ridge. But nobody could do it. And that's why, when he died, Peter earned one more name. The serial killer they couldn't cure.